I have to make sure my notes are ready. There they are. Oh, Moot, I have bad news for you.
What's that?
Because I'm doing the podcast in a different room due to my hip situation, my replacement hip, I do not have my normal mic and soundboard set up, which means no applause.
Oh.
We can't. I'm sorry. We can't start the pod with applause.
That's okay. When it comes back around, it'll be that much sweeter.
Right. I'll get louder applause. Maybe I'll get a standing ovation applause. The applause I normally play are only okay. So it's like, yeah, we're glad to see you, but we see you all the time. Welcome to the Carl Landry Record Club, a music podcast from the rights to Ricky Sanchez. I am Spike. That is Mootloo. Our intro music is from Philly's own Marian Hill. And on this podcast, on this very podcast, we like to talk about albums, occasionally some new singles. Moot or I pick an album every week. You pick an album every week, and we are designed to suggest music to each other the old-fashioned way, which is to just tell somebody why you like it. It is Moot's week. Oh, by the way, if you want to suggest an album, as I said, not you being Mootloo, you being the listener, as I said, there are a million ways to do it. Just go to carllandryrecordclub.com or visit us on X and go to the link tree in our bio there, and there's a way to submit there, or do it in the Apple Podcast reviews, or if you're listening on Spotify, right under the player, there's a way to do it there. So there's just like a million different ways to do it. So do it one of those ways. We've learned about so many new bands because of the listener suggestions.
Incredible. I was actually, that's strange that you said that. I had that thought as you were setting everything up there that I'm trying to think back. I know you kind of keep the archive on the site, which is, if you're a fan of the show, it's worth going back to that because so many records, both are suggestions, but I guess the most exciting thing probably for me, and I imagine for you, is the new discoveries, things that you overlooked or things that you just had never even heard of, you know?
Well, I like both. I like the ones that I had never even heard of that I end up loving, or a band that I had seen their name 600 times and ignored for one reason or another, and it turns out that I actually like them. I also enjoy the challenge of somebody suggesting something that I actually don't like or don't think that I like and go into it and try to find something that I like. So please let us know. And I don't think I've updated the archive in like about six weeks or so. So I'll go in and I'll do that too. If you go to carllandryrecordclub.com, there's just a list of every album we've ever reviewed. So I'll get to that. Anyway, two albums today. It is Mootloo's and a new song, if we get to it. It is Mootloo's week. So Mootloo's album is Getz Gilberto from 1964 from Stan Getz and
Joao Gilberto.
So the first name, say it again.
I've always pronounced it as Joao Gilberto.
Joao Gilberto. It's J-O-A-O. J-O-A-O. I should have looked that up. Joao Gilberto. The listener album comes from Jess, and it is Mute Math's Odd Soul, from 20, when I kept, there is some old soul to it, actually, by the way, but it's Odd Soul from 2011. Jess says she actually suggested three different albums, but number one was Mute Math, Odd Soul. Though the group has disbanded, the music they released on five studio albums was innovative and widely underappreciated. From New Orleans, the reminiscent at times of Traffic and Steve Winwood, 70s rock and funk, the Black Keys, and even Yes. The original iteration of the band included Paul Meany, Darren King, Roy Mitchell Cardenas, and Todd Gummerman, easily in my top favorite albums of all time. So we will get to that. And the new song is from an old band with a new album. That is Marvelous Three's Old School Metal Heart from their new album 4. Lead singer is Butch Walker, which is not terribly surprising that I would pick it. But very
and you
surprising.
Saw them in concert recently.
I did. I saw them in Atlanta. It was wonderful. We will talk about it when we get to it. Why don't we start with Getz and Gilberto?
Okay. Now, were you familiar with this, with these artists or this record?
Did you suggest a Gilberto thing before or
yes,
something?
Yes, his daughter, okay. Babel Gilberto. We did her record maybe a month ago, 2 months ago.
Okay.
A while ago, but not that far back.
So I remember that. And And we'll get into it when we get into the album, but I feel like there are things that I've heard on this album before, but I don't know if it's because if it's a cover or if it's a musical thing that it exists in a lot of other albums or something, but there were songs on this that sounded familiar to me.
Yeah, I think this is, even if you only have a passing interest in bossa nova music, you might recognize a few tunes on this record.
Okay.
It's a landmark album in that genre. And I think for most people, for many people, their initial discovery of this genre might be through that record. It was for me. And I think it's been the case for decades now because it's sort of a bossa nova 101. And we'll get into that. But Stan Getzen and João Gilberto, the album Getz Gilberto, released in March of 1964. It's considered to be the record that popularized bossa nova worldwide. It's one of the best-selling jazz albums of all time. So it catalogs as a jazz album.
Okay.
And it sold over 1 million copies. And you know, that's rare for jazz records. I believe, you know, there are certain iconic albums like Kind of Blue, like the one we discussed, that occasionally a jazz record will have that kind of reach. But although this isn't what you would consider straight ahead jazz necessarily, it's in that world and it cataloged as such and still is considered that, even though it's bringing in different sounds than maybe what you would hear like bebop or the more conventional standards or sounds of jazz.
What would you define bossa nova music as? Like, is there a way to define that?
Yeah, it's basically, let me see if I can break this down. I mean, it's a Brazilian form of music.
Okay.
And it evolved out of samba, which is, you know, a traditional sound in Brazilian music. But I think, to me, if I can describe it, it has very specific characteristics. Basically, I'll kind of track it because it's sort of emerged in the late 50s, and again, evolved out of the traditional sound of samba. And the artist that we hear, as well as the pianist, who's also the main composer, songwriter, they were basically some of the seminal musicians who established this sound. And it's tough to define as far as what it means beyond where it originated from. And
is it a know it when you hear it type thing?
It's sort of it's a sound that's identifiable. One thing I'll say is that, specifically, it's a Brazilian style of music that evolved out of samba. That's the general.
Okay.
But some of the characteristics that appeal to me that I love are, one, the sort of laid-back, smooth nature of it. I mean, there's no denying that. And when you think of bossa nova music and when this sound first hit in the 60s, you kind of identify it with a lifestyle. Sipping martinis, decked out at a smooth spot, James Bond vibes, you know. You'd even hear some of this music in the 60s if you see films that depict that kind of environment. But João Gilberto and Antonio Carlos Jobim, who played piano on this record and wrote many of the songs, they were two of the pioneers, basically, of this sound. It evolved in the late 50s out of Brazil and became very popular there and gradually started gaining popularity throughout the world. But it was this record in 64, you know, really they actually recorded in 63, only 5 years removed from when the style sort of first emerged, that hit the critical mass. And it became something of a worldwide phenomenon. Now, giving a little background on both artists, Stan Getz, one of the great tenor saxophonists of all time, a career that spanned 50 years from the early 40s until he passed away in 91. He's often referred to as the sound because of the warmth of his tone and the melodic clarity that you hear in his performances. And you hear that throughout this album. He never overplays. What I love about his playing is that it's not busy, it's melodic, and he generally is always mindful of staying within the composition. You hear core elements of the core melody in the composition, and he just kind of builds off those without going on too many tangents or straying too far from what makes the composition work in the first place. Now, João Gilberto was an iconic Brazilian singer, guitarist, composer, father of Babel Gilberto, who we discussed a while ago. Career that spanned 60 years, and he only just passed away a few years ago. Around the world, he's often been called the father of bossa nova, just to give you an idea of the significance of this record and the people involved in it. In his native Brazil, he's been referred to as Omito, the legend. I would say his style of singing and guitar playing exemplified this sound. I mean, I love powerhouse vocals, you know, but I love the other side of it, understated. He's more understated maybe than any singer I've ever heard. It's almost at a whisper at times, but he's unmistakable. You can't confuse him with anybody else. I always think of the Gamble and Huff thing of like, you know, we want great singers, but we want singers who are unique, and he's completely unique in his sound. One other big thing I'll say that I was kind of going to get to earlier, but the acoustic guitar in this music.
It's great.
And it's always a huge part of these records. And it's been a huge influence on me. When you listen, it's that rhythmic, syncopated hand-pick style, but you're picking the root notes with your thumb, bass notes, and you're kind of marking those. And then you can it's either a finger-picking thing with your other fingers or marking the chords. And there's a very particular style of acoustic guitar playing. When you listen to this record and a lot of other bossa nova, that acoustic guitar is at the center, is the centerpiece of so much of it. A lot of it builds out from there. And you know, Gilberto's style of acoustic playing as well, I think, was pivotal in the evolution of this sound. Now, it's interesting how musicians like Stan Getz started to adopt this sound. So even before this record, he had started bringing bossa nova into his music. In the early 60s, jazz had something of a both creative and commercial downturn. And I think musicians like Stan Getz started to look for other sounds and absorb sounds from other parts of the world. And he had already started really tapping into bossa nova as an influence. There's one big turning point, one specific show on one specific night that set the stage for this record and was just pivotal in the history and the emergence of this as a worldwide phenomenon. On November 21st, 1962, the first ever North American bossa nova concert was held at Carnegie Hall. It featured Gilberto, Antonio Carlos Jobim, who I'll mention a little more briefly in a bit, and Bonfa, Robert Menescal, Sergio Mendez, who's another legendary performer. Basically, it was a showcase for this sound, and this show, this performance made a huge impact. Now, after the Carnegie Hall concert, Creed Taylor, who produced this record, decided that he wanted to bring Jobim and Gilberto and Stan Getz together for what he said in his own words, a historical documentation of the genre style. So this is, there's something musicological about this record. His story, the intention behind it was, let's bring this legendary jazz musician together with these legendary Brazilian musicians and put them in a room and see how it all comes together. And he made that introduction. And sure enough, they recorded this record in 1963. The rest, as they say, is history. So going through the checklist of personnel, it's a tight-knit group. Stan Getz on tenor saxophone, Dragoberto on guitar and vocals, Antonio Carlos Jobim on piano, Sebastian Neto on double bass, Milne Banana on drums and pandero, and very important, this record marked the emergence of Astrid Gilberto, who became a star in the bossa nova world as well. She only sings on two songs, but they're, well, The Girl from Ipanema is probably the most recognizable
song.
Dude, I'm sure
awesome
you've heard that before.
That.
Yeah. Her voice, just this effortless resonance she has, and it's her phrasing, her timing, and it doesn't feel overwrought in any way. It just feels smooth and just feels natural, you know? And her two performances on this record, because she's on only two of the eight tracks, made a huge impact and launched her career. She was married to Dragoberto at the time, and I think they split up not long after, but it's a seminal album on that level as far as the emergence of another great singer. Now, this record, interestingly, was the first jazz record to win a Grammy Award for Album of the Year, which I'm not sure a jazz record could win Album of the Year in this.
No, would be pretty tough. I think you could have a jazz influenced record, but a straight ahead jazz record probably
not. And you can't. I guess it's tough to really call this a straight ahead jazz record either. This is also something. This is still at least partially vocal driven and song driven, as opposed to, and it's still the arrangements are concise. It's not stretching out for 10 minutes and doing that kind of thing. So it's still closer to pop music. Everything all right out there?
Yeah. I'm using this mic that I'm not usually. So normally I have a fader that I can just turn my mic down if I need a cough, but I don't have that. So there's a mute button on this other mic that I'm using, but it would not. I muted it, but it wouldn't unmute. So I was like hammering the unmute button.
Isn't it that weird when you're used to doing something in a particular setup and you have to readjust to do it differently? You feel different, right? Isn't
bro, that? I am convinced. I've done, this is my second or third podcast that I've done from this setup. I'm convinced they all suck. I'm convinced I sound
bad.
That's
maybe
I am. I need to be in my spot. Anyway,
yeah, it takes you out of your rhythm a little bit. Because I've experienced that sometimes when I'm traveling and we've done this, or I'm in a different environment and I don't feel quite the same because I have the setup that I like, that I'm comfortable with, you know?
100%.
But I think it's a psychological thing. Yeah.
I can't move my fucking mic. I like moving my mic. Can't, now I got to do it this way. Like, what are we doing
here? Well, you get back to it soon, you know?
Yeah.
It'll be all that much sweeter when you get back to it.
I'll love it. Ooh, podcasting from my normal chair. How sweet it is. Anyway, continue.
So this album won Album of the Year at the Grammys. So just to see the cultural impact this record had, and of course, a million seller. So let's go through some of the highlights. Got to start with The Girl from Ipanema.
Tall and thin and young and lovely, the girl from Ipanema goes walking, and when she passes, each one she passes goes when she walks, she's like a samba that swings so cool and sways so gently that when she passes, each one
Quite possibly the most iconic, widely recognized bossa nova song. The song that introduced many people throughout the world, especially in the States, to this sound. So many of the core musical ingredients are in this song right there. Understated melodic vocal delivery, the syncopated acoustic guitar. And that's those things, like their vocals, Astrid and João Gilberto's vocals and the acoustic, everything is centered around that. Everything is in service of that.
Well, and your point about like, it's hard. It's rare for music to seem relaxing to me and not boring, but there's something so like, have one drink and sit there in a comfortable chair in a dimly lit room about like, and her vocals are like the vocal version of the entire music almost. Like, like her vocals are the vocal representation of the music itself. If you could take the music and make them vocals, that is how she sounds.
That's a great song. Point. I love that breakdown of it because, yeah, she exemplifies what it is that you love about this sound. And, you know, I think what it is even though it's smooth and it's understated, there is a swagger in it.
Yeah, for
There's
sure.
A swagger in the
100%.
Music. Yeah, you know, so it's laid back, but it's not somber laid back. It's swagger, you know. It's got a certain a feel and a certain attitude to it, and a certain confidence to it that comes through, you know. And then listen to the rhythm section, incredibly nuanced, dynamic rhythm track that to me just perfectly complements what they're doing vocally. It's a minimalist style of playing, just marking the beats, and again, kind of playing off the acoustic guitar, creating more syncopation. But I love how in a sense dynamic these players are, because the way this was recorded was, as many jazz records have been, in the room with the players all together. It was recorded in 2 days, so it's a no frills thing, not a lot of overdubs. What you hear on the record, as is the case with many great jazz records, is that sound of people in a room listening, playing off each other. They had great tunes, great arrangements. So if you got that all locked in, why do you don't really need much else? If it's all in the performance, it's there. So a couple other highlights that I would mention. Destefino is another classic of the bossa nova repertoire.
Peito dos desafinados no fundo do peito bate calado. No peito dos desafinados também bate coração.
Another showcase for both Gilberto's distinctive style and Stan Getz's lyrical melodic sax playing. There's a winding nature to the melody that's another Jobim's signature. On the one hand, his melodies and his compositions, there's a simplicity to them, and the melodies tend to be instantly memorable, but simple isn't always simple. And when you listen to his tunes and you hear them on this record, there's a sort of winding nature to them. In other words, right when you think the melody might resolve in a certain way, there's still another melody at the end of that coming, and it's dynamic. I think that's maybe gets to part of what you're saying, is that what makes it not boring is also contained within the composition. One other tune I'll mention as well is Corcovado, which is the second song that features Astrid Gilberto. Just another great performance from her, and another signature Joe Beam composition, that distinctive winding sort of melody. So, I mean, this is just, to me, a record I always come back to. I discovered this a long time ago, and, you know, certain records you step away for a while, but you're never inevitably going to come back to it. This is one of those, and it's a chill listen. I mean, I think on the reissue, there's two alternate versions of two of the songs, but or two bonus tracks that are alternate versions of songs that are on the main record. But the core record is just 8 tracks, runs a little over half an hour. And what else do you need? You know, and it's a nice mix of both vocal, you know, vocal presentation and instrumental presentation. And I love, and just the songs with any genre, any style. It's like we always come down, same thing, the songs, the compositions, what's in the songs. That's what makes it.
So it was actually Corcovado that I came to the conclusion about her voice, like sounding like the music. Because there is a sax solo later or a trumpet solo later, or whatever it is. There's like a solo later, but it's really just like the vocal melody of the song, like as a solo later in the song. And I just think it's like a nice mirror of, yeah, of her voice or whatever, like an instrumental version of what she did earlier in the song. So I thought that song and that particular moment in that song was important as I was listening to the album.
Yeah, and that's a great point. That gets to the thing about Stan Getz that I think, I'm not sure just any other sax player would have worked with this project. Because one, yeah, he already understood this music. He'd already had a few records where he was influenced by this sound and in a way, you know, directly influenced by Gilberto and Joe Beam. So they, you know, he was already immersed in this, but it gets to what you said. You'll hear a vocal melody from the vocal and the sax pretty much just mirrors that.
Yeah.
It's so he doesn't stray too far from the composition, and it's all about keeping that melody in place and not going off to something that's just totally unrelated to the composition. I think that understated approach, that streamlined approach to just stick within the song is actually less is more is better in this context.
Yeah, for sure. And there's another song, Vivo Sonado.
Yeah.
So it sort of exemplified that relaxing thing that I'm talking about, in that it almost feels like the evening of a holiday, like at the end of a Christmas night or something.
Yeah, when you're chilling afterwards.
Fireplace, dim lit, drink in hand, you know, like just sort of thankful for everything around you and everything that's been done. And you make a good point also, to be able to do that and have a swagger to it, but also have it like wrap its arms around you in a comforting way is an interesting way to describe one kind of music. Because normally I don't think you would describe a music that is, you know, sort of soft and comforting as having a swagger, but obviously like it does, you know, and that James Bond thing, like all of these things sort of, I think are great ways to non-musical ways to describe the music, you know.
It's amazing how certain records, I don't find this with every record, but mm-hmm. some albums for whatever reason just immediately conjure up images for you. Like it took you to a place where you're thinking about something very specific. You know, after Christmas, you're chilling, something about this music brought you to that place. Now to me, I think of it more in the context of films, the James Bond thing, you know. Or even if you've been to a Steven Starr restaurant, you might hear something because that's along these lines, because bossa nova has intersected with a lot of other styles. It's in the years after this, because, you know, it's been in the world of pop music, global pop music, for over 60 years. So you've heard bossa nova come into hip hop settings, into electronic and dance music. And I recall on a few occasions being at a Steven Starr restaurant and hearing something, not necessarily this, but something that's influenced by this. This yeah. sound, but it's got a little more of the electronic feel to it, and it just seems right. You see people sitting at the martini bar. It's interesting how music, some records and some sounds just do that to you without you even thinking about it. They just conjure up some kind of image for you. It's not necessarily anything that's being even being said in the music. It's just what it makes you feel.
Yeah, it's a great record. Really cool record. I did not, when things are this old, I don't expect to enjoy them very much. But this one, I actually listen when I sleep because the tinnitus I have in my left ear, I listen to like rain stuff like in over-the-ear headphones. But I actually decided while I was listening to this, I was like, I could listen to this as I fell asleep and it could put me to sleep for sure. Like it is a... It is very relaxing music, and I thought it was very well executed and really cool.
Right on. I'm glad you like. I wasn't sure. I was on the fence as to what you might think about this because it's not necessarily in your wheelhouse. And sometimes with other jazz inflected records, I can tell it hasn't resonated with you as much. But I love that you love this because to me this is still pop music.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It's jazz, but it's still. You're a song guy, a melody guy, and there's plenty of that here. It's not just riffs, you know? So I'm really glad you liked it.
My problem with the jazz stuff is usually that I find it boring. And I think that is the pop thing you're talking about is I don't know where the song is going. It's just, I can tell that they're talented and they're good, but it doesn't go anywhere. But all of these songs seem to go somewhere, you know?
Right on. Well, yeah, I think too, it's important to note the work of Joe Beam in this and these compositions mm-hmm. as the writer, and he's probably the most legendary composer of Brazilian music and most iconic. There's also, if you like this record, there is a record that he did called Wave. It's an instrumental album, but it includes some of his classic compositions, and just the melodies that you hear in the guitar and the piano are just incredible. I mean, I think his style of writing has also been very influential. It's not, again, it seems simple, but it's not simple.
Awesome. Well, let's do the new song and then we'll do Mute Math.
Right on.
So the new song is from Marvelous 3, my old school metal harp. Marvelous 3 is Butch Walker, Jace Fincher, Slug McLee. They were in a different band called South Gang. Now, South Gang is the first like Butch Walker band. I'm sure he was in other bands, but that was the first one to ever surface anywhere. And South Gang was a hair band, straight up hair band. When you look at the videos, long hair, makeup, all that kind of stuff. And that South Gang disbanded. And then in 97, they're from Athens, Georgia, they formed Marvelous 3, which is, you know, power pop, 90s power pop, you know, all the way through. And this band happened at the same time. You know, it's an interesting time of music because we are after grunge. The post-grunge bands like Bush or whatever, Stone Temple Pilots are still sort of there. But there were also some bands doing this sort of thing. Lit had a big hit at the time. New Radicals had a hit at the time. Like they were a Handsome Devil.
They would put like New Radicals in the same song? That actually makes sense to me.
Yeah, I wouldn't, not in terms of like presentation, but in terms of like sonically, I think it was there. And even Matthew Sweet, I think we did Matthew Sweet record, Matthew Sweet also Georgia as well, the same sort of straight ahead poppy rock music, I think is what they did. So they put out a record themselves, cost them $4,000, and they actually got signed to Elektra because of support from 99X, which is a local Atlanta radio station that was like an alt-rock radio station, disappeared for a while, but they're back now. But they pushed them and pushed them and pushed them, and they get signed.
And this was in the 90s? Because I have a thought about Elektra. Elektra, in its heyday, and even into the 90s, was always one of the most adventurous labels. They signed Ween.
Wow.
If you were to see the early versions of Ween, which is the two of them and a drum and a tape deck, basically, and how bizarre some of that music was. It's incredible. It's almost a near miracle that they got signed to a major label, but they did. Elektra was always that, seemed to be that label that was taking chances on people. And I don't know if there's anything like that anymore, but it's as far as an imprint that, to me, just, you know, always was adventurous in what they were willing to sign. I think, you know, they seem to take chances on people.
Yeah. Well, they certainly took a chance on Marvelous 3. So they put out their major label debut in 98, the Hey album. And they had a song on there called Freak of the Week. What to do when they're all looking at you? Cause you're the freak of the week, cause you're on the TV. And Freak of the Week was like, if they had a hit, it was Freak of the Week. I think it got to number 5 on alternative charts. It was a radio hit. It was on MTV, all that kind of stuff. They had a couple of other songs that charted, but it was, this is the one that if it gets played anywhere, people know. So they end up doing 3 albums, and they disbanded the band in 01. And the way that Butch Walker tells the story is that, like, Elektra, who had their rights, had very little interest in the band anymore.
Didn't so that's want to the other side of it. It took a chance, but then they lost it.
Yeah.
There's always something negative at the end.
Yep. So Elektra didn't really have any interest in the band anymore. And they also had the rights to the band. So Marvelous 3 basically broke up. They broke up because it allowed them to do their own separate things and sort of and not be held sort of hostage by the label. So that was that. So that was that for like years and years and years. And I would
and
say
real
over
quick,
the last
Butch Walker's debut was right after that, wasn't it 2002? I think we did one of his early records.
We did Letters. We didn't do the first record.
Letters was the second one. Was the second
Letters
album?
Was the second record.
Okay,
yeah.
So he followed up immediately with his. He started his solo career like right out of the gate.
Almost immediately. Oh. Yep. Yeah. For sure. So Marvelous 3, so as Butch Walker ascends, both his solo career, which, by the way, his solo career never really has a lot of diehards, but there's never any real commercial success with his solo career, but the diehards love it, and a lot of those people are Marvelous 3 fans. Most of his success came as a producer, as a record producer.
Yeah,
like
he's
huge
so many
writer
big pop records.
Yeah. So in the last 5 years, I would say, and there was never any bad blood, and they repeated that over and over between Marvelous 3. In the last 5 years or so, you know, there was once or twice at a Butch Walker charity gig, the other two guys got up and they played a set together. And it happened like here and there, but never like all together. And then about 4 months ago, they announced that they would be doing a show in Atlanta. A reunion show, which my brother and I went to. They ended up doing 3 shows in Atlanta, all sold out right away. And then they did 3 at the House of Blues in Chicago. And after those shows went on sale, they announced that they were putting out a new record called 4, which is out now.
Now, do you know why just those 2 markets? Like, why didn't they do why didn't they hit more cities? Or are they planning on doing that maybe when the record comes out?
You know, no, the record's out. I don't know. I think...
Oh, this is the lead single from lead track from the record.
Yeah.
But I mean, is there a plan to, because if those shows all sold out, why wouldn't they, I don't know, at least hit New York, LA, a few other markets?
Atlanta is their home market. So not surprising they would sell out there. They could probably have sold out 10 shows in Atlanta. Chicago, I would guess, is probably another, just was it historically a big market of theirs? I know that there was interest in other markets doing that tour. But I also wonder I said I was at the first Atlanta show. It is almost impossible, I would say, for a show to have lived up to the anticipation that I and I think everybody else in that crowd had for that show. And it lived up to it. Like, and they obviously, the production was outsized the room, I would say. In that the production was really like slick.
Was it the Fox? It was the Fox?
No, it was the
Tabernacle.
Tabernacle.
Now, how big is that room? I've played a couple of the other bigger rooms in Atlanta. I've never been to
1,500, maybe something like that.
Oh, it's
maybe
smaller. It's like, I thought it was I thought it was bigger than that. Okay.
No, I it felt like maybe a little bigger than the Troc, maybe 2,000, maybe, but right around there. But my guess would be what they spent on that show wouldn't have made sense in every market that they like it. My guess would be it wouldn't be a profitable tour the way that it was sort of designed. And I wonder if they wanted to do anything that wasn't like exactly the way that they wanted it to be. That is, you know, sort of my gut. I don't know. I don't know that that's the answer, but I do wonder if like, I wonder if they even, they probably made money on the shows, but I wonder if you're in a market that's not an instant sellout, if bringing that production along for all of those shows makes any sense financially.
And you feel they wouldn't want to do something more pared down because that's just not the spirit of the music or the show.
All I would say is after that first show, my brother and I, we were there, we were in Atlanta for another night and we could have just gone to the next night. We decided not to because the show was so perfect that I didn't want anything to ruin it. And like, this is not going to be a, Butch Walker doesn't make his money doing this. He makes his money producing records. Like, I just wonder if it's better left the way that it is.
Sometimes you don't want to, you have one magical experience and you don't want to taint that. You know?
Yeah. And the other cool thing about it is they played with an extra guitar player, which was actually Jace's son. I think he looks like he's 19 or 20 years old. I guess grew up a fan of the band and he was fucking rock star. It was awesome. So they put out this record, which is great. If you love Butch and you love Marvelous 3, this record is great. I would say that this record is a little more Butch than it is Marvelous 3, if you were to identify it, but he's obviously like the primary songwriter and all those things. And, My Old School Metal Heart is the first song on the record. And in true Butch Walker fashion, it basically has like three hooks in it.
Yeah.
it's almost like he's showing off. Like the bridge is a hook and the hook is the hook. And even like there's like a which is also like kind of hooky as well, which gets back from the chorus into the verses. It's just like a monster, you know?
He's such a skilled pop songwriter. When you hear some of his other work with other artists and on his own, this song uses a device that I love. It's actually something you hear in a lot of Dylan songs where I don't know if you want to call it the main chorus or the pre-chorus is a hook in and of itself, but it's busier lyrically.
And then
the hook pays off with the title line.
Right. Yeah.
You know, and then you're right. There's another hook that's that falsetto bit that comes later.
Yep.
But I love how he sets up the title tagline at the end of the chorus. Cause you've already heard something that's ramping up melodically. And then when he hits you with that line, Old School Metal, I mean, it just puts it over the top. Now that I've heard more of his work, he's got certain signatures that he does, but he packs in as much melody as he can to every portion of a song, not even necessarily in the body of the song. Like you said, there's oftentimes something in the guitar, right? Or there's something in just a vocal, phonetic vocal thing that he throws in there.
And I think he's a great lyric writer. It's not like particularly introspective ever, but he does paint a great picture, you know? And I think for their comeback album to open up with the lyrics, I'm not drinking anymore, I'm not drinking any less, I cleaned up myself, I guess, how you like me now. It's like, it's awesome, you know? I don't know that there's another band in existence. It's probably Silverchair for me to get as excited and have such an amazing payoff from the album and from the show as this could have been. But it's a great tune, a great record. The record is four. If you like this kind of music, I would recommend listening to it. And if you miss the shows, you probably miss the shows. But man, but the shows were just excellent.
And I'm sure this is true live, but for a trio, the sheer density of the sound, there's a lot going on there. That's a big sound for what you would conventionally think of a trio. Now, I don't know how much is Butch's production approach, but
Well, and they play live with two guitar players. Like they play
expand Butch, a little bit.
Butch plays, and then Jace's son played guitar as well. So they played with two guitars live.
And then one other thing, just the balls to the wall energy right out of the gate.
Oh yeah, yeah.
I mean, there's no chill setup. This thing is just full throttle right out of the gate. Never lets up. That's another thing with him as a performer is, you know, talk about like basketball players, they leave it all out on the court. When he gives a performance. And I haven't seen him live, but on record, he leaves it all out on the court. You know,
they streamed the second show, the second Tabernacle show, and I have that video. I'll send you the video. You can watch the show. I haven't watched the full second show yet, but I'm sure it mirrors the first show a lot, and you can see it. You just fucking
see. I assume he's that way live too. It's just sheer energy coming through.
Yeah. And you're sort of exhausted at the end of every show. I would say as well, though, that this show was the perfect length. I think it was about an hour 35 or an hour 40 or something. It was everything about it. Wouldn't have changed a thing. So mute math. Time to do a little mute math.
Yes.
Where's my mute math note?
It's time to do a little mute math.
Time to little mute math. Odd Soul, which came from Jess. Mute math came together about 20 years ago as a partnership between Paul Meany and Darren King. Paul Meany ended up being guitars and vocals. Paul Meany keys and vocals. And then Darren King is drums. They had played together in one of Darren King's earlier bands. And after that band broke up, they continued to sort of like work together long distance. Meany was in Missouri and Darren King was in New Orleans, and they would do the thing where you remember this is like late 90s, early 2000s. So they would send each other tracks, work on it, send it back, write lyrics to it, blah, 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 blah. And they liked it so much that Meany moved to New Orleans to get sort of like more, what's the word I'm looking for? More,
sort of more, a band feeling or?
They felt there was something to the project, which was originally called Math. Then they recruited Greg Hill to play guitar, and Hill was a friend of Darren King's, and they started working on a demo, and they worked with a lawyer friend of theirs to actually like form their own sort of like mini label imprint, and they for the EP, and they got a development deal with Warner Brothers. What's interesting is before the first album came out, they ended up in a dispute with Warner Brothers and ended up suing Warner Brothers, and they ended up releasing the first album under a renegotiated deal with Warner Brothers. But part of it was how Warner wanted to market the band. And you'll find this interesting because it's something that we've talked about before, as Warner wanted to market them as a Christian band.
Christian band?
Yes.
Wow.
And Meany did not want that to happen. And I guess,
what was that like, based on? I mean,
well, so like Earth Suit, which was the band that they had before, there were like, I guess, religious undertones to it, but much like, I guess, sort of like what we had talked about with Creed to an extent, is that like Meany said that there were songs about religion, but not inspiring people to be religious or whatever. And then it ended up being their second album was actually sort of like anti-religious or whatever. But like they were brought up religious. They had, I guess, King called them, quote, weird religious roots. And even there was a quote in Rolling Stone that called them kind of a Christian rock band. And Warner wanted to market them as a Christian rock band because, as we've talked about, there is a sort of built-in audience there from a financial perspective. It probably could limit your ceiling, but it also raises your floor. So their debut album comes out and gets a lot of sort of, momentum behind it. They do a lot of tours with big acts. They tour with Linkin Park. They tour with Incubus. They tour with Alanis Morissette. They tour with 30 Seconds to Mars. Wow. They do all of the festivals, you know, the Bonnaroos, the Lollapaloozas, all that kind of stuff. And they ended up getting a little bit of radio traction from a song called Typical from their first album. So then they released the second album, which is Armistice, which has similar sort of like cool band success, I guess I would say. I think it debuted 15 on Billboard or something like that, the Billboard album chart. And then as they are recording this next album, which is the one that we're talking about, which is Odd Soul, they record, Greg Hill quits the band before this album. And they go and they decide to record this album entirely at Paul Meany's house, without Greg Hill, without a replacement guitar player. And in interviews, Meany and Hill both say that like this album, and with no, they told the label they wanted no label feedback until the album was done. So they got no label feedback until the album was done. They all played guitar on the album, I think. And they, Meany and Hill said this was the most collaborative album that they had done. And I thought that there was, I was reading a quote with Darren King about the when the album came out, and I thought you would appreciate it. He said, one thing that happened in the recording for this album was a love for the Meters, and we really tried to play a heavy version of their beats. They're really the best instrumental band of all time. They're based out of New Orleans, and their song Sissy Strut is one of the best. But a huge range of influences went into the making of this album. Modern bands back to Black Sabbath. We wouldn't bury ourselves in those influences, but we'd skate along the edge of them. A lot of it came from the three of us. We got a lot of new equipment, a new synth, new guitars, new drums, and we started beating it all up. Those influences pop out at random in various times. I mean, you listen to music your whole life and listen to so much that it's going to pop out. The influences can get pretty random in comparison to the work we do. Our guitar player left at the beginning of writing and recording the album. I find it ironic that it's the most guitar-heavy, bluesy Guitar Hero record right after our Guitar Hero would leave. That doesn't just happen. Paul also asked me to come in on writing lyrics, which is a huge honor. So that was part of the evolution of this band. I thought it was interesting.
I knew there was a reason I liked it so much, because there is that undeniable groove element. And now when I'm thinking about some of the drum parts, there's that very particular kind of, there's particular drum patterns that you hear in New Orleans music, or that New Orleans sound that you hear in the Meters records, that I'm thinking there were elements of that throughout the record that made it just so musically satisfying. The thing with this band too is, it's tough to pinpoint what they are, because I guess at the core, it's what you would identify as indie rock, but there's this strong blues element. There's that funk, that heavy groove element. And then at times it almost veers into something with some of the more keyboard synth heavy songs that almost could be electronic. So they kind of straddle a number of different areas.
It sounds like an album that the record label was not involved in.
Yeah, because they would have had all kinds of criticisms to streamline it, not go in too many different directions. How are they going to market it? Yeah, it's the standard thing.
Yeah, I think the opening track. Really sort of shows everything. Is it the title track? This is the opening track.
Yeah.
The title track. Yeah. I think it sort of shows everything that they have, because it sort of does have that electronic rock aesthetic, almost in the same way that Muse has that same, you know, sound and aesthetic at sometimes, but also it's definitely rock music, and it definitely has like a funk groove to the entire thing. And then they do this interesting thing with the vocals where it's distorted and it sounds contemporary, but there's something about the timbre of the voice that does make you think of like Steve Winwood or classic rock or something like that. Like, that's not a crazy comparison to make at all.
No, absolutely. It's pulling from all that. And at times it also put me in the same musical space as the Black Keys, because they have
Yeah.
There are even some things vocally that he does that are similar to Dan Auerbach, the octave vocal.
Yeah.
Where you'll hear the lower against the higher falsetto part or just the higher part and making that sort of one lead vocal, which is a very, I love that sound. And you're right, yep. There's a certain fuzz on the voice that's just awesome.
There's a couple other songs that I really liked. All or Nothing. Thought is completely different in that it almost has like an 80s postmodern sort of soundtrack song kind of feel. And it was the one song, you know, Jess didn't mention when she wrote in about influences, but it was the one song that brought Radiohead to mind. And also sort of like interesting that Meany can do different things with his voice in different songs, like just sort of a completely different way to attack a song than he does like in the intro, in the first song of the record or in other songs.
He's an outstanding singer. He to me represents the kind of rock singer I appreciate the most, is that he's a rock singer, but he's a soulful rock singer. And I think of like, yep, Chris Cornell and people like that, where, yeah, it's rock music, but whether it's a straight up soul R&B influence or it's more the blues, whatever it is, it's coming more from that, equally from that place. And like I always talk about, whether it was the hair bands we discussed or any tentacle of rock music, if I can hear the blues in it, I'm all in. That's why I like the Black Keys so much. The blues element is there right out of the gate in that first song, you know, and you hear it, sure. And it's in his vocal. And you're right, he's just incredibly versatile in the way he sings. He takes a different approach, different sort of phrasing depending on the song.
And then the song that I actually liked the best, thought it was the best song of the album, is Equals. God is love, it's sweet how they feel each other. First, it's toward the end of the album. As far as like song construction, it is the most straight ahead, I think, pop song on the album, in that I think it has the best hook on the album. Also, it's got hand claps on it. And I think the chorus is really pretty. And I think once again, there's sort of like, has that sort of Steve Winwood vibe to the chorus and to the vocal attack on that song that I really enjoyed.
The tune, I'm not sure if this one stood out to you, but Tell Your Heart, Heads Up.
Good tune. Yeah.
It's another standout to me. That one showcases the range they have within their arrangements. I mean, it can go from very sparse and just kind of vocal in the drum groove to something that's vast. And sometimes it happens section to section. They're able to kind of navigate that in a way that feels natural. Because sometimes you can do something very dramatic that's, okay, here's a vocal and drum line, then all of a sudden, boom, everything comes in. Their thing feels more nuanced, the way they transition between the different sections. And there's, on almost every song, there's usually one specific musical thing that happens that is kind of driving the track. On that one, there's this great organ line that you hear throughout the track. It's not up front all the time, but it's a rhythmic and melodic thing that you hear in the keyboards, and it just puts that song over the top. Now, he strikes me as someone who does a lot of home production, or he's kind of the production mastermind, I assume, behind all this.
Yeah. This album is listed as being produced by the band, and by the way, Mute Math you know, Jeff said they're disbanded. As far as I can tell, Mute Math at this point is just him, is just Paul. But it still does exist, but it's him. But he does, yeah, he's a do everything guy.
Yeah, and I think there was a certain movement of bands that came out. I keep coming back to Black Keys, but I don't know how you would define this sound exactly, but this is a sound that I identify with a certain era, and a good era. Well, I mean, in the best way possible, like early, mid-2000s. It was considered indie rock, but it was more soulful than a lot of the indie rock you heard.
Yeah, I wanted to say the mid-aughts is mid-aughts. When there's a lot of bands. I wouldn't say that sound exactly like this, but you would have put in this category. It was a good time for like big indie rock, if that makes any sense, from like Keane to Snow Patrol to, not that they sound like this band, but you could have put them all in the same sort of like vibe or whatever. That was when Muse sort of took off, was that same time as well.
It's interesting. Those are all great bands that actually have a range, but I understand what you mean as far as radio, they would probably be played in the same playlist, right? I mean, you probably have a better sense of that, but were those bands when you were programming?
Yeah.
Were these the kind of bands that were sort of coming into the promo people were bringing to you? Because it seems like this also had a big moment on radio as well.
Yeah. So they brought these bands in. There weren't like a ton of hits out of these bands. You know, Snow Patrol ended up having a hit with Chasing Cars, even though they had other songs on the radio. And really that song's an obvious hit, but was obviously also spurred by being on Grey's Anatomy, helped that song as well. Keen, yes, had, you know, like they were on the radio. There weren't like a ton of hits from these bands, but like they were texture bands that would be on the radio. Like they would never get to power. They would never be like the biggest song in your station, but they would always be on the station.
And what would that mean? Like low, mid rotation kind of, not the peak rotation.
Yeah, like at the it depended on the station, but like I think at the time you would probably play a power record like 40 times a week, and then a mid rotation record you would play like 21 times a week, and then light would be like 11 or something like that.
And is that your call as the programmer to determine what stays in what part of the rotation, or is that kind of a
at the time? Yeah. Yeah. I mean, at the time
you have the call, there's not someone like that you have to confer with, or that's, no.
We had it was the first time I ever worked with a, what's it called, consultant, and who would work with other radio stations who could give you not specific information, but give you sort of like general information about how the song was working in other places. So if it wasn't working where you were, it was working there. But it's funny, I ended up in a big argument with our consultant. I can actually say, like Dave Biesing, he's not a consultant anymore. We had a healthy argument, and then had a very nice come to Jesus after I had left for both of us, a nice sort of like apology in that I guess I just didn't trust the consultant because I wanted somebody to give me pure honesty, and like consultants were on some level very busy trying to keep their job. So they wouldn't give you hard truths all the time. And also I felt like they were also swayed by labels, and I felt like they were also swayed by who else they worked with. And it was neat information to have, but like my point always was, well, I can find out what song is working in other parts of the country by just looking at how much they're playing it. Like if you tell me the song is testing great and they're only playing it in mid rotation, why is that? Like that doesn't make any sense to me, you know? So that's not to accuse Dave of having any untoward sort of motivations, but I think it's a difficult job to do perfectly the way that I would want it, that I would feel comfortable taking that advice.
And that's interesting because, you know, as a programmer of that station, every market is different.
Yeah.
I mean, there are certain things that become across the board hits, but just because it's happening in LA doesn't mean it's going to work as well in Chicago, right? It's not necessarily going to hit in the same way unless the band is already hitting it big and they already have like a national scope. But if it's a band that's still emerging, I would imagine you can't necessarily take cues from other cities, or is that, or can you? Is that the whole point of the consultant?
Well, I mean, you can. Like, you know, people aren't different. Markets are different. But like, you know, you could, there are some songs that will work in some places and not in others. I will take a lot of the blame in that. In that I was young, and like, I just didn't want to be told what to do.
Yeah, that's fair.
You know, so I had a pretty, I had good relationships with some record labels, but also pretty combative relationships with others. Like if I didn't think a song was good enough, I wasn't going to play it. Like I was like, fuck.
And then you get inevitably the pushback from the promo people and the tug of war that happens there.
Yeah, I was not good at the politics part of it. I would be different at this age than I was at that age. I was just all about like what was right and what was the best song. I'm like, how the fuck did I even know? You know, like I was just so, and it's not like I knew the market all that fucking well either. You know, I just moved there. So it's not like I knew it, but you know, whatever, all is, it was an interesting time, but I remember one particular fight where like Dave was like, kept pushing me to play this Arcade Fire record. And I was like, this song is not a hit. It's never going to be a hit. I don't care fucking how cool it is. Not a hit, not a hit, not a hit. Like that's what I would, but we argued over that for.
And there's something to be said. If you're put in that position, you do have to, what else do you have above all else?
Right.
Or what do you have above all else other than your instinct? That's why
you just
you're
have
in
your
that
gut.
Role.
Like that's and why I get paid.
There's a reason you're in that job is actually to try to follow those instincts. But there's other things infiltrating and trying to make you second guess that. Yeah. I can see how that becomes agitating after a while because you know you're given this responsibility. You know,
sure. And but then the other part of it is like some of it is politics, and some of it is like hey, like, and some of it is not every song you play has to be a hit. You know, like some songs will never make it there. But some songs are good to play from an image perspective or from a, you say that you played it or, you know, like a song that that you're playing 10 times a week, it's very easy for nobody to hear. Like there's no way a song is working if you're playing it 10 times a week. Not from a familiarity perspective. Like because when you just think of the math of it, okay, one of those is in the overnights. So throw that one away. Right? Or let's say it's 14 times a week. So that means the other seven are spread out evenly between the other 18 hours a day, once a day.
That's not enough to really, for it to really catch fire. Yeah.
Not really. If, I mean, think about if you listen on your way in and on your way home, and on your way in, maybe it's a morning show that talks a little bit more, and on your way home, maybe it's 35 minutes. 20 of those 35 minutes are going to be songs, or 22 of those 35 minutes are going to be songs that I already know that you like. And then in there, you might hear one of my powers, which is one of four songs. And you may hear one of my mediums, which is one of like seven songs. And then you maybe you'll hear, you'd be lucky, you probably won't, twice a week, you'll hear one of the lights. So you could go 3 weeks of listening at the same time every day and maybe hear the song one time.
So the low mid-level rotation is not a path to a hit. It has to be that higher volume plays. Yeah.
You have to bang. And it needs other influences, right? It needs to be big in other places. It can't just be you. Certainly not anymore. But at the time you could, like if you play a song light for 3 months, you could have a heavy listener that maybe hears that song two times.
That's crazy. I mean,
that's not how that works.
It's interesting.
You know?
You wouldn't think that. It's a little counterintuitive, but when you also consider that you're also having to play catalog material, right? You're not just only doing new tracks. Then that makes sense in that context. It's competing with things of the past too. So
yeah, and you're using that the things of the past as sort of like a trade. You're basically you're telling the listener like I'm going to play you something new, but before something new and after something new, I'm guaranteeing you I'm going to play you something that you will like. So you trust me, even if you don't like the something new, that you're going to stick around and you can trust that something will be good after. It's just like strategy, you know, because if you play two songs in a row that you're lucky enough, if all you, and then I'll wrap this up, but like all you need to do is like be in the car with somebody and watch them listen.
Right.
If a song comes on the radio that they do not like, click. They change immediately.
Yeah.
So if you can get, and unfamiliar is for most people the same as do not like. Do not know is similar to do not like for most people. So if you can get them to sit through one of those songs, God bless you. Two in a row, no chance. You have no chance, you know? So you have to be strategic about all of it, you know?
Very particular signs to it. You know, and it makes sense because you're working within tight parameters in radio.
Yep. Yeah.
You know, and that's a lot of tough decision making.
That was off the beaten path. Any other songs on the Mute Math record that you wanted to hit before we sign off?
The one other tune I yep. had down here was Blood Pressure. Blood Pressure. I just love the single note blues riff on that. That's another tune that
yep.
kind of put me in the same space musically as Black Keys. I mean, you hear the blues in that, and it's just the one line. But I like that it's a line that it sounds like a part, but it's actually a hook in and of itself. And you hear that throughout the record, guitar hooks. Not just the vocal hooks, but there's a lot of instrumental hooks in it. So just a great record.
The very little I've listened to the Black Keys, which I've never really been interested in them, but like I can hear it in the songs that I've heard. I can certainly hear this band in the songs that I've heard.
That would be a good tour, these two together, I
yeah,
think.
I'm
that
sure.
would be
yeah.
similar appeal.
All right. We will talk to you next time. Suggest an album. Go to carlandrewrecordclub.com or hit us on social or Apple Podcast Reviews or right under the player on Spotify. Until then, we'll talk to you next time.
Stay free, my goose.